I know that many of you people know how to have a good garden. And, you know, down in our area, there's a little animal called a raccoon. I don't know if you have those up here. Do you have those up here? Okay. Well, the ones down where we live, they seem to know when corn is ripe. And so you can think, okay, I'm watching that corn crop grow, and you know the ears are forming, and the silks are getting brown, the yields are filling out, and tomorrow I'm going to harvest some of that corn, we'll put it in the freezer, and that night the coons come and just pull the cobs down and bite into them and make a big mess. So imagine thinking, you know what, I'm going to fix this. We're going to put up a coon fence. And so you get some woven wire mesh, and you know, 8 feet high, and you put posts all around your garden, and you embed the mesh in the ground, and so you make this coon fence. And you get around, almost all the way around, and you're short 8 inches of wire. So you say, well, you know what? I don't really have time to, I'm too busy today. I don't have time to go to the store and get more wires to make it complete. So I'm just going to stop it right there. And then I'm going to compensate for that by watering my corn extra and putting on more fertilizer, and I'll pray that God will keep the coons out. What do you think will happen? Your extra prayers and your extra water and your good fertilizer won't help. The coons will find that gap in the fence. Have you ever been to a wedding and you notice what a joyous occasion is, the wonderful beginning, these two beautiful young lives, they've been led together to bless one another, and then you observe that same marriage 20 years later, and it's disaster. I mean, the sparkle is gone from their eyes, there's contention and strife, they see each other with faults instead of with beauty, and that wreckage is compounded in the lives of their children. How could such beauty turn into such disaster? God has actually given us a detailed history of a marriage that was like that, so we can learn without repeating the mistakes. I want to really emphasize here, sometimes people say, experience is the best teacher, but it's a hard master. I don't like that proverb, because experience is not the best teacher. There's lots of stuff that you don't want to learn by experience. You'd like to just read a book and find out, nope, that's not the way to do it. You don't want to learn by experience that a 6-inch foundation of concrete is not good enough for a house, do you? You need to talk to somebody who already built a house and know how deep to make the footing and how deep to make the concrete, or read it in a book somewhere. You can learn all of that without experience. You don't have to learn a shred of things about adultery by experience. You can read the Bible and find out everything you need to know. So God has blessed us so marvelously in giving us His book with His wisdom, so that we can learn without having to learn by experience. Genesis chapter 24. It was a wonderful beginning. The father was intervening. He wanted to make sure his son did not marry a Canaanite, so he sent his servant out to the homeland to find a wife. And chapter 24, verse 12 and following, clearly this servant was a man who knew the Lord. He prayed as he came into the city, and he saw a beautiful lady. That's quite a bonus. Verse 16. She was a virgin. That's an important issue. You should be a virgin and seek a virgin. And she's polite. She says, drink, my Lord. Verse 18, she's kind. She gave to him. And, you know, he prayed as he entered the city and asked that the one for his master's son would be one that would offer to give the camels a drink. Well, I checked in the Encyclopedia Britannica to find out how much a thirsty camel can drink. And a thirsty camel can drink 25 U.S. gallons, that's 95 liters, 95 liters of water in 10 minutes. Now remember, Rebecca was not just turning on a spigot and running water into a trough. She had to go over to the well, pull that water up, put it on her shoulder, carry it over, dump it into the trough. And she said, I will water your camels until they're finished drinking. So those camels had just come in off the desert. They don't have any idea how long it'll be till they get another drink, and so they're just slugging it down. What does this tell you? She's a hard worker. Well, this servant is amazed, and he wondered and remained silent. At first, he doesn't know whether God has prospered him or not, because he doesn't know if she's a believer. And he finds out that she's part of Abraham's family. So he responds in worship, verse 26. And then he goes home with her, and of course they wonder who this fellow is, so he tells his story and says, can she be the wife of my master's son? And the father and her brother answer, yes, it's of the Lord. And so you see that in verse 50, and this servant responds again in worship. That's one of the clues in being in the right way if you are prompted to worship. If what the path you're taking makes you feel like worshiping God, it's a clue that you're on the right path. If a path you're taking makes you feel like not worshiping God, you better take heed to a warning signal. So Rebekah was willing to break tradition and go immediately the very next morning to marry Isaac. What was Isaac like? Isaac had exemplary character. You can tell that by how he was willing as a young man to be bound on the altar of sacrifice. And when Rebekah got back, she met Isaac when he was meditating in the field. In other words, that shows his pattern of life. It's very likely the servant got back early. I mean, it's surprising to find the woman you want on the very first evening, and the very next morning you leave with her. So he wouldn't have been expecting her yet. So that means he was out there meditating as a pattern of life. And he loved Rebekah. He finally was comforted concerning Sarah, who had died 3 years earlier. So notice, both Isaac and Rebekah have outstanding character. God led them together. They have the blessing of their parents. What more can you ask? Beautiful, wonderful. And during their marriage, they continued with good things. There was a crisis in their marriage. Rebekah was barren for 20 years, and Isaac had a proper solution. Isaac prayed for his barren wife. That's chapter 25, verse 21. She conceived twins. That shows Isaac was effective in prayer. And then Rebekah, she noticed a commotion in her womb. She didn't know what was going on. I mean, she'd never been pregnant before, but she knew this something is unusual here, so she inquired of the Lord, and God answered with a statement of purpose, chapter 25, verse 23. What you see here is that both Isaac and Rebekah had significant relationship with God and direct communion with Him. Notice their actions were far superior to the actions of Abram and Sarah regarding Sarah's barrenness. Furthermore, Isaac was a good man in the community. He had favor with God and man. His public life was a good reputation in society, Genesis 26. The only exception was his bad testimony regarding deceiving as having Rebekah as sister rather than wife. He left this disputed wells without a fight, and God spoke to him during this chapter in affirming blessings, and the neighbors saw how much he was being blessed by God, and they wanted to covenant with him because they saw that blessing. Well, finally, two sons were born. Esau was hairy like a garment. He was a man of the field, a skillful hunter, and Jacob was some kind of man living in tents. And translators are sort of over the map on that one. Actually, the Hebrew word is tam. It is the same word that is used to speak of Job when it says Job was a perfect man, Job 1:1. I wish they would have just translated it that way when they were here. Anyway, the behavior patterns were different. Esau did what he liked. He went out hunting. He neglected the family business. And obviously, it would be an easy opportunity for relaxation on days when hunting was easy. And Jacob stayed at home doing the work, focusing on the family business. And then you have this story of the foolishness of Esau. Esau sold his birthright. He came in one time from hunting. He was weary, and he saw Jacob doing what he usually did. He was there helping do the work. And he says, you know, give me some of this red stuff. And so I think Jacob probably was, you know, weary of that kind of thing happening, and so he made a bargain. He said, sell me your birthright, and I will. And Esau says, I'm ready to die. What good's a birthright? Sure, I'll sell it. I think Jacob was shocked because he says, swear to me. In other words, make it binding. Now, even if it involved only temporal issues, it shows what a foolish man Esau was. Sell your birthright for one common meal, lentils and bread. Utterly short-sighted. He was not forced to sell. Jacob did not trick him. Esau wanted instant gratification of his appetites. And the root of Esau's foolish response is clearly stated, chapter 25, verse 34, thus Esau despised his birthright. And the New Testament commentary clarifies that point. The sale demonstrated that he was a godless man, he was a fornicator and godless. You find that in Hebrews chapter 12. Now, he despised the birthright with its spiritual blessings and responsibilities, claiming he was about to die. It's very possible he wasn't particularly interested in flocks. They would be too much work. But look at the huge loss. Esau would have sat on Abraham's knee. There was opportunity for him to know what he was discarding. Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac was born. Isaac was 60 years old when the twins were born. And Abraham died at 175. That means the twins were 15 years old when Abraham died. And so Abraham lived with Isaac and Jacob. You see, Esau had a belligerent disdain for God's program. He wasn't interested in the covenants. He was more interested in hunting than about the covenants of God. And instead of facing his own foolishness after he had sold the birthright, when he came into his father later, he accused Jacob of taking his birthright. Esau was a playboy. He was sensual. He took pagan wives. He did what he felt like, chapter 26, verse 34, even in the context of arranged marriages. And then when he realized his parents didn't like it, he solved the problem by doing what? Getting a wife of the descendants of Ishmael, as if that fixes things. Now, why was Esau like this? It's because Esau was like his father, only worse. He was acting like his father. Turn to chapter 25, verse 28. It says, Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. Now, it's interesting that Esau, for a bowl of pottage, sold his birthright. And later on, we'll see that Isaac, for a meal of venison, gave away the blessing. And they both said they're about to die. So you can see there's a connection here. You see, a wonderful fence is useless against the raccoons if a gap has been left in the fence. And fleshliness in the parents brought disaster in the next generation. You see, Isaac's lifestyle of fleshliness promoted fleshliness in the family. I mean, there's good things said about his public life. God publicly blessed Isaac, and he was a peacemaker in a jealous community. But there was disaster brewing in the home life. He deceived regarding Rebekah being his wife for supposedly a good cause. Well, that deception was done, and it was a wrong way of dealing with a danger he faced in the community. But it was also a terrible precedent for his wife when she experienced a crisis and her husband was doing something very bad. She resorted to deception too as a necessary way to solve the problem. His preference for Esau was an exhibition of his fleshliness. And that encouraged fleshliness in his son. It drove a wedge between himself and Rebekah. Subsequent events proved that she felt it was absolutely useless to talk to him about the importance of carefully following what God had said regarding the future of their two sons. You see, even the blessing of God will not prevent family disaster if we disregard what God has said. Now notice in chapter 25, verse 28, he is fleshly in siding with the carnal Esau. He ate of his game. Now, what's going on there? He loved Esau because he ate of his game. Was it that Isaac was centuries ahead of his time? Oh, that wild game, that has the best vitamins, the best minerals, the best nutrients. Nothing like this old insipid domesticated stuff. No. Was it because it tasted so much better that he felt invigorated for days after eating that stuff? No. Why do we know that? Because Rebekah could fix goat meat that tasted exactly like it. He couldn't tell the diff. In other words, here is my macho Esau boy that could go out and capture that game. Isn't that wonderful? I love it. The contrast is Rebekah. She loved Jacob, who was perfect. Isaac loved the fleshly. Rebekah loved the spiritual. Here's a house divided against itself. And Isaac wanted to give Esau the blessing and the supremacy in direct opposition to what God had said. He ignored Esau's obvious lack of qualification. Here was a man who's so foolish, he sold his birthright for one common meal, and you're going to make him the leader of the family? Here's a man who married heathen wives. Here's a man who isn't concerned about his parents' advice. Here's a man who makes poor choices. Here's a man who takes one poor choice and adds another poor choice. Now, Isaac went deliberately against the direct, revealed will of God because God had said, without question, the older will serve the younger. One time after I spoke on this subject, somebody said, well, but maybe Isaac didn't know. Maybe Rebekah never told him. That is unthinkable. Here is a woman who's been barren for 20 years, and because of Isaac's prayer, God grants her conception. She conceives twins, and she doesn't know that they're twins, probably. But there's such a commotion in her womb, she wonders what in the world's going on. So she inquires of God, and God obviously answered her verbally because he gives these details that you couldn't see in a picture. And it's unthinkable that she wouldn't have told her husband. And so here is Isaac. And when you read chapter 24, you realize he wanted to give Esau the supremacy in the family, explicitly reversing God's decision. In fact, it's very clear that he determined to leave nothing for Jacob. Because if you glance at chapter 27, verse 29, he says, let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren. Let your mother's sons bow down to you. He said that to Jacob, but he thought he was saying it to Esau. And so he's saying, let your brethren, namely your brother, bow down to you. You're supreme over the brother. He's reversing what God said. But not only that, when you look at verse 37, Esau said, is there not a blessing for me? And verse 37, Isaac answered, indeed, I have made him your master, and all his brethren have given him as servants. With grain and wine I have sustained him. What now shall I do for you? In other words, there's nothing left that I can think of to give you. Obviously, Isaac intended to give Esau the supremacy and to impoverish Jacob. What a horrible thing. You see, Isaac's fleshly living year after year in loving the fleshly one and encouraging that fleshliness made him want to thwart God's will in this area. And no wonder his favorite didn't care about God's will. You know, when parents live in a fleshly way, foolishness and fleshliness is magnified in the children. And so, Isaac's utter fleshliness in wanting to give his favorite but unqualified son the supremacy against the direct revealed will of God set the stage for this. But not only that, his fleshliness pushed his wife into temptation. Temptation to be fleshly herself. Rebekah was so concerned about God's promises, she was willing to deceive in order to fulfill God's promises. In other words, violate God's will in order to fulfill God's promises. You know, if there's a conflict between what God's commandments are and his promises, what are we supposed to do? Obey the commandments and trust God to fulfill his promises in some way that we don't realize. But she didn't do that. She proposed a deception of her husband. And Jacob was concerned about that. He said, well, if my father finds out I've deceived him, I'll get a curse instead of a blessing. She said, let the curse be on me. She was willing to suffer to make this happen. And so instead of a spiritual solution, she resorted to a fleshly solution and was guilty of fleshliness just as real as Isaac's. And she led her son, Jacob, into fleshliness. You see, Isaac's actions had actually helped encourage Esau in his fleshliness, and Esau is fleshly, and now his actions give Rebekah a temptation to be fleshly, and she actually teaches Jacob to be fleshly. Jacob went in. He had Esau's clothes on. He had skins on his hands and on his neck so he would feel like a goat. And Isaac says, "Who are you?" Oh, he didn't want that question, did he? "I'm Esau, your firstborn." "Well, how is it that you found the game so quickly, my son?" Jacob was a quick thinker. He said, "Oh, the Lord your God brought it to me." Yes, right out of the goat pen. And so he lied and lied and lied. And finally, Isaac is convinced and he gives the blessing to Jacob. But he thinks he's giving it to Esau and he gives Jacob the supremacy over his brethren. Now, you know what the tragedy is? God had prepared something wonderful for Rebekah. He had spent many years preparing this in order that she would have faith for this very occasion. But she threw it away. God had lovingly given her 20 years of barrenness. And you might say, "What do you mean?" You see, if a woman would be barren for a year or two, they might think, "Well, I was just getting adjusted to marriage or whatever, and now success." But she is barren year after year after year, month after month after month, hoping for a child, never getting any. And so after 20 years of that, she knows that she is hopelessly barren. There is no possible fix except what? Supernatural solution in answer to prayer. And guess what happened? Her husband prayed for her and God answered her prayer, his prayer, and she conceived twins. So you see, that's God's object lesson. Listen, you have an impossible problem that you cannot solve. I can solve it through prayer. God prepared that object lesson. You know what she did? That loving object lesson that she had, and it had to be a long period of time so it would be clear to her that this is an impossible situation. She is hopelessly barren. That object lesson she threw away and decided to be fleshly and deceptive instead. I mean, what if she and Jacob had retired to the tent and prayed instead of resorting to deception? How could God have answered that prayer? I gave that as a homeschool assignment, to my children one time. Okay? Just suppose they prayed. What would be a way the story could have ended? I mean, there are lots of things. God could have confused Esau into putting the wrong herbs in the stew and make it taste terrible. Or God could have caused all the deer to barely escape. That's what wears hunters out, right? You know, he's stalking this thing, gets up close, and then, you know, his foot jostles a little rock. And the deer's gone. I'll never get that one. Oh, but then he's walking along, he sees these tracks and says, "Oh, yes, those are fresh. In fact, I know the habitats of that animal. It'll go up this trail, out this way, down through this ravine, over there, up beside this lake. If I run around this other way, up this steep place, down this valley, come up this other way, I can come out this place, and he will be right there when he comes out, and I'll be there, and I'll get him." And so, of course, he hurries up, and he does this, and he's sweating, and he gets up to the place, and he's there, and he's all positioned, and there comes the deer, just like he thought, because he's wise in the ways of these things. And he's just ready to release his arrow, and a crow goes, "Ka, ka, ka," and scares the thing away. I'll never get that thing. I mean, God could have kept him busy for days. God could have actually caused Isaac to bless the wrong person by mistake and use the word Jacob instead of Esau every time. Have your parents ever called your child by the wrong name? I was speaking to a group in Shanghai, and I asked them for suggestions, and they gave me one that I thought was very good. If Rebekah and Jacob had prayed, and every day God prevented Esau from a successful hunt, one way or another. And so Isaac says, "Oh, Esau, don't worry. I mean, I know you're a great hunter. You just had bad luck today." So Esau goes out the next day. And for one reason or another, he's not successful. And Isaac says, "Don't worry. I've seen you be so skillful. I know you're going to be able to do it." And this happens day after day after day after day and week after week. And finally, Isaac gets the point. There is a supernatural reason going on here. see what is going on. And Rebecca could say, you know what? The reason is because you are trying to violate what God said years ago. There could have been a change of course without disaster. But see, Rebecca and Jacob chose instead to operate faithlessly. They viewed God as very small. He's too small to solve the problem. And you see what a tremendous slap in the face of God this is. Now, what happens is, in this crisis, fleshliness in Isaac, in Esau, in Rebekah, and Jacob brings confusion. Isaac's physical blindness is symbolic of his spiritual blindness. If you live in a fleshly way, you will become spiritually blind. That's just how it works. When a man violates God's will, he cannot see the obvious. He gets blinders over his eyes and he just sort of see through the cracks. I mean, Isaac did not see the significance of the facts he knew. I mean, there was no problem with the stew. He didn't say, "Bleh! This is goat!" He repeatedly knew what? Something is wrong here. What did he say was wrong? The voice is wrong. It feels like Isaac. It feels like Esau. It smells like Esau. It tastes like venison. But the voice is wrong. Now, wait a minute. Esau's hands and Jacob's voice. Is that possible? That's not possible. That should have signaled, this is a problem. I mean, there's something so obvious here. It didn't matter if Isaac was blind physically. It was so obvious, that should have told him, this is a problem. What's the obvious answer to this problem? Call in a servant. Hey, who is this in front of me? Call in somebody with eyes to see. Signal that problem. But you know what Isaac is doing? He is trusting in himself instead of God. He's feeling Jacob, asking questions. Oh, yes, what about this? He's impressed by the smell of Esau's clothes, not knowing Jacob was wearing them. He's impressed by the feeling of these goat skins, not knowing that Jacob was wearing them. You see, this episode shows Isaac's lack of spiritual perception. He's on the verge of transferring leadership in the family, and at that very moment, he's confusedly attempting to reconcile conflicting signals regarding who's standing there. I mean, clearly, he is out of touch with God in this episode. Now, that doesn't mean he was out of touch with God all his life, but he's out of touch here. It's a momentous event. If you're transferring the spiritual leadership of your family, you better know who you're transferring it to. Now, this is a great contrast to the old blind prophet, Ahijah. Ahijah was the one who told Jeroboam, you're going to have 10 tribes, and there's going to be 2 for the kingdom of Judah. I'm going to take the kingdom and tear that part off and give it to you. Well, Jeroboam, instead of following God, was a wicked king. And so, one day, Jeroboam's son got sick. And he's concerned about what will happen to this son. So he sends his wife to go ask Ahijah what's going to happen to the son. In the meantime, Ahijah is blind. And the wife comes with a disguise. She's dressed like a peasant woman. She has a gift that would be appropriate for a peasant woman. And as she approaches the door, blind Ahijah, who hasn't seen her, hasn't touched her, doesn't know she's dressed in peasant clothes. He says, come in, wife of Jeroboam. Why do you pretend to be another woman? I have bad news for you. Now, how could Ahijah say such a thing? Because God told him that ahead of time. You don't have to have eyes if you're in contact with God. You see the great contrast? Ahijah is blind. Isaac is blind. But Ahijah is in touch with God, and it doesn't matter what the deceiver does. Ahijah knows the answer. Isaac is out of touch with God. And he trusts in himself, a feeling. You know what? People are repeatedly fooled by trusting in their senses instead of getting in contact with God and understanding God and his ways and learning from him. Our human tendency is to think that communion with God is an optional luxury to be enjoyed in moments of piety. The greatest disaster of Isaac's fleshliness was that he deprived himself of communion with God. That is his greatest disaster. And that fracture involved a frightful cost to him and his family. So what were the immediate results of this fleshliness? For Rebekah and Jacob, this single act of fleshliness brought success. I mean, they achieved the goal. Jacob was blessed. He was given supremacy. It worked. God's purposes stood. So you might say that the scheme was wonderfully successful. Incidentally, that's very common. It's very common, whether in individuals or in churches, when a fleshly method is taken to accomplish a certain result, the result gets accomplished. But with that fleshly result will be bad baggage that is a disaster. Now, how successful he was dramatically illustrated by the account when Esau came to get his blessing. For Isaac and Esau, what were the immediate results? Persistent fleshliness brings disaster. Now think about the way God operates. God often allows a repeated lifestyle of selfish indulgence, but God will always fulfill what he predicts, and woe will be the portion of the person who attempts to thwart God's predictions. When Esau comes in for a blessing, chapter 27, the passage emphasizes the absence of blessing for Esau. Esau calls for a blessing, if you glance at the chapter, verses 31, 34, 36, and 38. And repeatedly, Esau's blessing was described as taken away. Verse 33, someone else was blessed. Verse 35 and 36, Jacob took away Esau's blessing. Jacob got the blessing that Isaac perversely thought he was giving to Esau. Esau is left with practically nothing, and Isaac's comments shows how perverse Isaac's actions really were. He was determined to not only give Esau the supremacy against the will of God, he was determined to impoverish Jacob as well. Notice also, in verse 39, Isaac's pronouncement for Esau is not introduced as a blessing. It's just Isaac answered and said. That's a contrast to what he said earlier when he was speaking to Jacob. Verse 27, Isaac blessed Jacob and said. And then notably absent in the statement for Esau is a reference to God as the divine giver. Verse 39, Isaac answered and said. You see, it's not connected to God here. And verse 27 and 28, you have the contrast, the Lord has blessed, may God give you. That's what was said there to Jacob. Now, the wording is a contrast in Isaac's pronouncements. Isaac hears Esau's plea, and so he tries to give some kind of blessing. And the initial phrase, he spoke of the fatness of the earth and the dew of heaven. And both are prefixed by a Hebrew particle, men. It's similar to what he said to Jacob in verse 28. And the Hebrew word men means either away from or it means some of, depending on the context. Now, since the wording is so similar, Esau may have thought, I'm getting a blessing after all. So he could be clutching at any straw. But notice this, verse 28. For Jacob, God will give something to Jacob. That requires the idea of some of. For Esau, he does not say God will give him anything. Instead, he spoke about where he will live. And that requires the idea of away from. And this is confirmed about the details. Jacob will be sustained by abundant grain and wine, verse 37. Esau will be reduced to living by his sword, verse 40, not grain and wine. So, the Hebrew must mean away from in Esau's case. By the way, that comes clear if you read Luther's German Bible. It specifically says, Ohne Fähigkeit der Erde und ohne Tau des Himmels. It's also borne out by modern translations, New American Standard, and similarly ESV and NIV. And so it corresponds to Cain getting expelled from the ground and from the land. So he's condemned to be a wanderer outside like Cain and Ishmael. Thus Esau will live in a dry and fruitless land, the exact opposite of Jacob's home, verse 28. And Esau's barren homeland in Edom's wilderness is a fulfillment of this and a picture of the outsider and the castaway. Verse 40, look at that. Esau's future occupation is by sword. Now, if you're going to go hunting for animals like Esau used to do, would you use a sword? No, it's what instrument do you use? A bow. And here it says, by your sword you will live. What does that tell you? He's going to live by doing what? War and plunder. Killing other people. The predator Esau, who used to hunt for animals, is going to hunt for men. And then Esau will break the yoke. It's a picture of a subjugated animal wildly breaking loose. And so when Isaac attempted to bless Esau, it was more like a curse than a blessing. You see, it was an improper deathbed farewell. He should have included both sons. And Isaac intended to give everything to Esau, and Esau was glad to comply, but Esau got nothing. And the emphasis is, Esau lost everything, and Jacob gained everything. What were the long-term costs of fleshliness? Each family member experienced long-term losses when they attempted to live life on their own terms instead of God. Esau's problem was that he wanted part of God's blessing, not the entire package. You know, there are many people like that. Oh, I'd like God's blessing on this area and this area and this area, but they aren't interested in devoting their whole life to God. But the way Esau lived prevented the blessing, and then he was frustrated and sorrowful. He was frustrated because he didn't have the blessing. He wasn't frustrated because he wasn't living right before God. That's one of the things to ask yourself. When you get into a strait because you've done things that are wrong, are you frustrated because your life has fallen apart, or are you thinking, oh God, I've sinned against you, restore my relationship to you? Isaac. This episode is a gigantic judgment from God on Isaac. He essentially pronounces judgment on the son he wished to elevate in direct opposition to God. Verse 33, when Esau came in and he said, my father, Isaac trembled exceedingly. Who are you? He knew instantly that was the real Esau. And you see, he knew he'd been caught in this terrible game and he could not reverse it. Rebecca, what did it cost her? Obviously, it precipitated Esau's murderous hatred toward Jacob. And she's got a new problem now. She has to separate her favorite son from him because if he kills Jacob, then the avenger would need to kill Esau, and she would lose both sons in one day. So she says, you know, go away for a few days until your brother forgets what you've done. What a naive statement. Something like this you would not forget, not even in many days. But she is not really able to be totally honest with her husband. So she says, you know what? I'm just so grieved about Esau and the wives he took. So please, let's send Jacob back to the homeland to get a wife. And Isaac says, oh, okay, it's a good idea. See what's happening? Rebecca is the leader manipulator, and Isaac is the follower. And what else happened? Rebecca is left lonely at home. There would be very little love from Esau, whom she had helped cheat. There would be very little love from Isaac, whom she had helped deceive. And it's no indication that she ever saw her favorite son again. What happened for Jacob? The worst thing that happened to Jacob in this was that he lost his good character. Remember I said back there at the beginning, it said Jacob was a certain kind of man dwelling in tents? Tam. It means perfect or upright or blameless. Let me just give you a few references to where you can see that. This same word is used. Psalm 37, verse 7. Mark the blameless man. Psalm 64, verse 5. Evil men shoot at the blameless. Job. Repeatedly used. Job 1, 1 and 8. Job 2, 3. Job 8, 20. Job 9, 20. 21 and 22. Proverbs 29, 10. Men of bloodshed hate the blameless. Song of Solomon 5, 2 and 6, 9. My dove, my perfect one. You see, at the early stage in his life, Jacob is described as blameless. But once he participated in that deception, he is no longer called Tam. What a loss! And it planted the seeds for a terrible harvest with Jacob the recipient. You remember? God is able to pay back, and when he pays back, oh, it's effective. When Esau came in and Isaac heard that voice, he said, who are you? And Jacob went over to the homeland. He saw a beautiful girl that he loved dearly. He loved her so much, it says he worked for her for 7 years. It just seemed like a few days he loved her so much. And he married. And when he woke up the next morning, "Who are you?" The woman who was in bed with him was the wrong one. God knows how to pay back. God is known by the judgment he metes out. Psalm 9, verse 16. People think, "I can disobey and get by. I can be fleshly and get by. I can follow God a little bit over here and I can do what I feel like over here." Watch out. You know what happened to Jacob? Jacob learned the hard way what it's like to deal with a cheater, namely Laban. So he worked 7 years, married the one he didn't want to marry. So then he married the one he wanted and worked another 7 years. And then he was going to go home. And Laban says, "You know what? I know that I've been blessed by the Lord for your sake. So stay. What wages shall I give you?" And Jacob very wisely said, "You're not going to give me any wages. But here's what I ask. The spotted, the streaked, and the speckled will be mine. And if I have any of the solid colored ones, you can call them stolen." What's he doing? He's letting God do the branding. That took faith. And Laban, cheater that he was, "Yes, that's a great deal." And he took his sons and had all the solid colored animals moved to one side. 3 days' journey away. And he had all the speckled ones moved aside, and Jacob kept the solid colored ones. Now, do you see what he's trying to do? If he moves all the speckled animals off to the side, 3 days' journey away, there won't be any genetic mixing, and Jacob is keeping the solid colored ones, Jacob will get practically nothing. Well, you turn over a few chapters later, chapter 31, and you find out that they had lambing time, and all the animals bore speckled. Laban is mad. So there's some for Jacob. So he says, "You can have the spotted ones." Next time, what happened? All of them were spotted. "You can have the streaked ones." Next time, all of them were streaked. What's going on? Chapter 31 tells us, "Your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times, but God did not allow him to hurt me." 10 times in about six years. And then here he explains it. Verse 10, "And it happened at the time when the flocks conceived, I lifted my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leaped upon the flocks were streaked, speckled, and gray spotted." Now he saw in the dream that the rams were streaked, speckled, gray spotted. If he had gone out to the pasture and looked at those same rams, what color would they have been? Solid color. See? God was showing what was on the inside of those animals, what's called the genotype. And what you look on the outside is the phenotype. And so, to the natural observer, they're just white or solid color, whatever. But not speckled. But on the inside, they've got genetics for these different traits. And so God just managed the genetics. So, okay, Jacob, here's what you deserve. And Laban thinks, "Well, bad luck that time. Okay, you can have the spotted ones or the streaked ones, whichever." God just manages the genetics. Whichever cells meets whichever cells. And they all came out like that. God took Laban's stuff and gave it to Jacob. It's very clear. It's not that Jacob cheated Laban and took his stuff. You see what Jacob did? He learned his error of deception. And he was very careful to let God be the brander so that he could never be accused of being a deceiver with Laban. Now, what does God do? God did not leave Jacob on the ash heap. Just because you've been fleshly at some point in your life doesn't mean you have to always be in a disaster. In other words, God does pick us up from where we are if we repent. But Jacob was not done reaping. His own sons deceived him into believing his favorite son was dead. You know, schemes of violating God's will are always much more expensive than people imagine. And if you take the way of the flesh to accomplish a certain goal, often it will work. But it will have baggage along with it that is absolutely disastrous. There is a sowing and reaping, according to the New Testament. If you sow the wind, you reap the whirlwind. If you sow to the flesh, you reap corruption. And both Isaac and Rebekah sowed to the flesh, and they both brought disaster on their favorite child. And sin also brings a terrible reputation, even after repentance. Jacob has had the reputation of a deceiver, although Jacob lived very carefully with Laban to avoid any accusation of dishonesty. But there is hope. God will take us if we come to Him in repentance. And God intervened for Jacob after he made that disastrous choice to heed his mother's advice. By the way, in case you're feeling too bad for Jacob, that poor little Jacob listened to his mother's advice, he was probably about 80 years old at that time. Just do the chronology. Anyway, always have God's program and God's purpose and means as the way to achieve God's program. Don't say, I'm going to follow God's program and I'll use the devil's methods to achieve that. See, that's exactly what people do. You know, when you use the devil's methods to achieve God's program, you're actually serving the devil in that instance. Jesus said to Peter, with his great opportunity, you'll be a foundation in the church. He said, get behind me, Satan. You mind the things of men. In other words, you're fleshly, instead of minding the things of God. Fleshliness will sabotage your marriage in ways you cannot imagine. Isaac's fleshliness was the root cause. It set the stage for Rebekah's fleshly breach of integrity. You know, a wife's temptation again and again, many times a wife will see the husband doing fleshly things and she will try to compensate with some other fleshly mechanism to make up for her husband's fleshliness. That's a temptation that occurs over and over and over. So husband, watch out. If you operate in a fleshly way, you are probably building a temptation platform for your wife to be fleshly too. What is the key to success in our families? A beautiful beginning is not a guarantee. Here was one marriage, Isaac and Rebekah, that was so beautiful at the beginning. Such wonderful character that continued into the marriage. But when fleshliness was indulged in, very quickly it turned into disaster. You see, we have to say no to fleshliness, even though it seems like it's the only possible solution. I was talking to a church leader one time and I confronted him with something he had done. And he said, I just felt like I had to do it. I said, in relation to something he said to me, I said, can you imagine Jesus saying that? No. You know, if it's contrary to the character of Jesus, you better not go down that path. Fleshliness always includes a lack of faith. We have to be willing to obey God, even if that obedience requires a miracle. We have to shut that gap in the fence. Don't just pray that no coons will enter. Anyone have any observations or comments you'd like to make? Questions? Any testimonies you'd like to give about when you were fleshly? We're opening it up for whatever you want. Yes, Ray.
I think I'll pass on the confession for fleshly decisions at this time. But just in regards to your statement that Jacob was very careful to not do anything, this whole discourse about peeled sticks, what's that all about?
Yes, that's a hard question. And I don't know the answer to that question. I'm open for lots of discussion from you farmer types. that can tell me more about that. I have never heard a discussion that really sounded satisfying to me. It's always sort of a shifty kind of thing, and so I'm wide open for wisdom. So I'll be glad to entertain anything about that. But the point I was making about deception, he was very careful to say, we're going to do it like this, and so anybody could look at those animals, and they could know exactly which one belonged to him, and he was letting God do the branding, and I think that's a marvelous thing. So hopefully we can interact on that point. Anything else you want to mention? Let's bow our heads to pray. Father in heaven, we offer you honor and thanks for recording this story for us and for recording these details that we need to hear, even though we find aspects of them that remind us of situations that we've seen. Help us to resist the temptation to be fleshly. Help us to love you with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. Help us to seek what your priorities are and implement them to the best of our ability. Lord, help us to act in faith and to walk in your ways and to obey, even if it looks like obedience will destroy the very thing that you've promised. Thank you that you can do better than we can ask or think, and that your solutions in those situations are absolutely marvelous. Lord, help our hearts to be perfect toward you so that you can show yourself strong on our behalf. Enable us a heart that really does trust you, love you, have your priorities, delight in your presence, and help our children to learn the same thing. In Jesus' name.